to another episode of the Hero Movies Podcast. It's great to have you guys with us again. And Anne, I'm very excited about our guest today because I don't know if you knew this. Our guest is Abel Gonzalez, who has been on American Ninja Warrior. And you guys will know by now that I am like a huge fan. Abel, I don't know if you know this, but a few days ago, we actually had on Pauline Avila as a guest on the podcast.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Big dog's wife there.
Yeah, so Houston. She's great. I've hung out with him many times. And yeah, that's a great, great person. Great family. Jody's an awesome athlete. And he's been here many times. Love the guy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so great. And so, on that episode, I was talking about my son, Silas. So last week he started going to a ninja gym up here in Chicago called Ultimate Ninjas. And so then my daughter wanted to do it. And so my daughter is 8. And so Abel, so she just went yesterday for the first time and she did the 10-foot warped wall.
Wow. 8 years old, 10-foot warped wall.
Like jumping up and down. But then she was looking at the 14-foot warped wall and just saying, how did they get up there every single time?
Yeah, it's a big difference. Yeah, from 10 to 14, but she'll get
it. Oh my goodness. So we'll talk about that, but this podcast really isn't about just Ninja Warriors. it's part of it, but it's also that Abel, we had read a little bit about your story. And so when you were on a couple weeks ago, they had a little bit about your story, but then I dug a little bit deeper and I wanted to have you on just because you have a very interesting background where you've overcome some challenges. And so welcome to the podcast.
Yes, thanks for having me, and yeah. Nice to meet you, Lori. Appreciate that.
And if you guys can see Abel, he is in his gym. So for those of you who watch on YouTube, you guys can see it's pretty inspiring just being in those facilities, I think. So Abel, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and you're in Texas now. So how you got to Texas?
Yeah, I'm going to try to keep that kind of brief because it's a really long and difficult and I remember there was a time when I was doing interviews and I couldn't even tell that part of the story. It was so emotional, you know, it was just so difficult to say the words, but now I'm much better at it. And that's why I enjoy speaking because I think it's also self-healing at the same time. And it also can help people. Right. But I was born in Chicago to very young parents. My father had just turned 20 years old. And my mom was 17 and I already had an older sister. You know, I had a sister that was 3 years older than me. So that means that my mom had her when she was 14. And so we were in Chicago and everybody knows this now, but Chicago is a very, very tough town to grow up in. And there's a lot of things going on over there. And it was the same back then too, you know, there's drive-bys and shootings. And, you know, I grew up in a very unstable environment. We never really had like a house, an apartment. We were always just jumping around and stuff from house to house with cousins and aunts and uncles. And then at one point when I was 10, this was kind of like the bottom of it is that my mom and my dad, they had a little tire shop where they sold tires, used tires and new tires, in the world's like the largest outdoor flea market in the whole world. It was called Maxwell Street. It was there in Chicago. So my father rented a lot there. He sold tires. And then by the time we got there, he had already put a bus in there, took all the seats out, and we were living in that bus in that flea market right there in Chicago, like as close as you can get to downtown. You know, I had my older sister already, and then I had 3 younger brothers at that point. So there was, there was 5 children, and then my dad and my mom, and we were living in that school bus where they had taken all the seats out, and that's where we lived. And that place it's a tough place. You know, there's a lot of crime there. There's theft and drugs, and, you know, we lived off of the money that my father made at that flea market, you know, and that was it. That's what he did as a young entrepreneur. But he was an abusive alcoholic. You know, my mom couldn't put up with it anymore, and he was, you know, and I talk about this and I learned about all this, but he was very insecure. He was a big, strong guy that could have done almost anything athletically with his life. And that was really surprising in my mind, in my perspective, and looking back at it, he literally had the choice to be like a professional football player, basketball player, or baseball player. He was such a big guy, so strong, so naturally athletic, talented, but he didn't have a patience and he didn't have a respect for authority. So he dropped out, and he dropped out of school, dropped out of sports. But he was just insanely talented. It was really ridiculous. And my mom and strong, so he was intimidating and stuff. But he was abusive to my mom. And then just one day she was like, that's it. You know, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. And she decided to divorce him. And once she did that, and you know, it was just a complete destruction of himself and the family.
I just want to say thank you for honestly sharing that, because as you said, it is a healing process when you actually speak that out. So you could either like shed tears of brokenness or shed tears of healing that brings you together. And so I just want to say thanks. And I really hope, and I'm grateful, honestly, for your story, because we were just talking to somebody else on the another podcast who was talking about homelessness and how complex of an issue that is, and how some people are couch surfing, you know what I mean? Going from families to family, and the reasons why. And one of the reasons was like violence in the home, domestic violence. And also, you know, so, and that it affects the children.
Oh my gosh. It's a very traumatic event. No matter how old you are, you know, I would say if your parents are going to get divorced and you're probably maybe after your mid 20s, it's not going to affect you as much as it would normally. But anybody that's under that, you know, it's going to affect them in some way, because it's just a traumatic thing to go from your entire life, you've known this foundation of these two individuals that were helping you become who you are. And then all of a sudden that is just broken in half. Yeah. So it affects you. It's very traumatic. There's a lot of science behind the trauma, how a divorce is probably the second most traumatic event that you can go through other than actual physical abuse. And in that household, we went through both. You know, my father was abusive to me after that, you know, because my mom wasn't around anymore. But that happened when I was 10 years old. You know, I had younger brothers, and I always saw myself as a big brother that was going to take care of his younger brothers. You know, I had always thought of myself as that, and I don't know where that came from. I don't see it very often now in a lot of kids, but I was very protective, and I was going to make sure that they were going to be okay. But when that happened, when they got divorced, this is where a lot of like these jumping around and this and being very unstable, having an unstable childhood. But my mom at that moment made a decision. It's a very interesting decision that she made. There was my older sister, right? And there was four boys, and I'm the oldest boy. I like to do this because it kind of shows you what happens. But from the two boys, she decided that she wasn't going to be able to take care of the two older boys. And she said that she was only going to take care of the two younger boys, who were probably like just getting out of Pampers. You know, they were young. They were, you know, 5 and 6 and stuff. And so me and my other brother, Matthew, who was 1 year younger than me, so he's 9 and I'm 10, she literally just ghosts us. We no longer exist. So she takes my older sister, and she did that for a reason. My older sister has a different father. So she took my older sister and the two younger brothers, and she moved out. And she moved into one of her sister's house. And she left me and Matthew there with my dad, you know. And so my dad wakes up the next morning hungover and upset that my mom is gone. And he's like, well, where did she go? I was like, you know, she just left. She just told us she was going to leave, and she didn't tell us when she was coming back. And he knew then that was it. Like he just knew it. So he just went into this rampage of drugs and violence and went after her and did all things. A very, very traumatic thing that happened. Even SWAT was involved. Like it was really bad. Between that gap when he got in trouble with the law and my mom decided to leave and just left me and my brother there, us two, me and Matthew, were just being passed from house to house, cousin to cousin, aunt to aunt. You know, we're just passed around. It felt like we were passed around for like 6 months. It might have been two. It might have been one. I don't know. But it was just so much to try to take as a child. And luckily, some people did step up. And they showed that they cared about us. But some of our family members were not very helpful. They actually made fun of us. Some of our cousins made fun of us. Some of them didn't care what was going on. But my mom would not even check in to see where we were. You know, she wouldn't check if we had food. So I remember, you know, after I don't know how many, like I said, I don't know how many weeks or whatever days that was that happened, but it seemed like months. One time, this is an example of what it means to be like ghosted by my mom at that point. One time she actually did come back, and we were at my aunt's house, and we were staying there, and we were just eating whatever we could and just trying to find out what was going on with our parents. And she walks in, and I'm like, hey, mom, man, where have you been? It's nice to see you and all sorts of stuff. And she doesn't even look down to see me. She doesn't want to notice me, right? So she walks past me, and I'm like, well, what's going on? She didn't hear me or what? So she goes and she grabs the phone off the wall, which is a landline phone. I mean, this is like early 90s and stuff, or mid 90s. Grabs the phone and goes into a room and closes the door. And she calls, and at that point, that's when I found out she had a new boyfriend. She calls him, and she's just on the phone with him for hours. I don't know what happened after that. I don't even remember. I just know that I didn't exist at that point. So that's one of the examples. You know, it's like it literally was invisible to her. And my brother, Matthew, has his own stories of the same thing. You know, and it's really crazy to hear his stories and compare them to my stories. And like, dude, that was real. You know, that was really real. That was real. And I've talked to her about it now. And she said, you know, she didn't know what to do. She was young. She was very young. She was like maybe 25 or something. She was very young, 26. And then Chicago is a hard place to grow up in. And if your family is very competitive and not supportive, you know, maybe you do something like that. But she knew that Matthew and I were a little bit older. We were a little bit stronger and that we could probably take care of ourselves generally as long as we had a place, a roof over our head. And that's kind of what we had to do. Yeah.
So Abel, did that make you more aware of other kids who might be coming from broken homes or who have like risk factors of abuse or neglect?
Yeah, I have a very, I used to think that this story was a dream. I used to think that it was, but it is real. And I remember my friend, but it is very common and it's very tough, especially in Chicago. But during one of those like days when my mom was not there and my father was not there and he was out just doing drugs randomly, partying, stuff like that. There was a time when right before they actually divorced, where my parents were fighting and I'm like, man, this is terrible. And I don't want to hear this. I don't want to be around this. You know, they're yelling and fighting and my dad, this and that. So I left. I literally walked out of our little apartment that we were staying in the basement of one of my cousin's house. And I walked to my friend's house. He lived about three blocks away or two blocks away. And I went to his house and I got there and I go in and the same thing is happening at his house. His parents are fighting and you can hear like people being pushed around and things being thrown. And he's right there and we're the same age. We even have the same last name. We're friends and it's from school. And I'm like, I went to escape that. And I went to his house and it's the same thing going on in his house. And then that's when I was like, dude, what is going on with parents? Like, why is parenting this? Why is this thing this way? What's going on with parenting? And I couldn't believe it, but it was like, you can't escape this. You know, it was really interesting to go through that. I look back at it now and sometimes it just feels like a dream. It feels like it wasn't real, you know, but yeah, that I remember my friend, you know, we used to watch Power Rangers together and stuff like that. And it was just very interesting to see that. Looking back at all these experiences now as an adult that's, you know, almost 40 years old, I see why those things happen. I know why this happened. I didn't, and they affected me differently when I was 15 and 20, when they do the way they do now. And I see them from a much bigger picture looking down at those times. You know.
That's an incredible lesson to learn when you're a kid. Because you think, well, I'm going to go somewhere where I'm going to be safe, which is completely normal. You just want to be safe. You want to be, and so then you think, oh, my friend, his family, I'll be safe there. But then, like, I think what you're saying is that we just don't know. But I feel like what you're doing and what you're modeling is that we need to speak it out so that people realize it's actually a reality in way more people's lives than we think. And so, yeah, in order to like come around and actually come around as a community and provide the support that people need.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about it. It's like how it's really hard to change an adult perspective. It's really hard to get them to see things in a different way or a different light, especially after they've gone through so many experiences, you know. So it's like, how do you solve this issue? How do you go after these difficult times with children because of their parents, right? The parents is the issue, but also their parents were an issue and their parents were an issue. So this is something that's been gone down the line and being continued on in this way, which we don't want it to continue. I'm sure my father doesn't want me to be an abusive husband when I'm a husband. He doesn't want that. But why did he become that? You know, maybe he saw that. And I think about all the bad times that I had and everything and that I went through with my parents. I was like, man, what did they go through? You know, because something happened to them. So I don't blame them. I don't take it personal. I mean, my father was physically abusive to me, verbally abusive to me, you know, and I'm like, I don't take any of that. I don't take it personal because if he does that to me, somebody must have been doing that to him. And back then it could have been worse. So I don't blame them. I don't blame the adults, but I do want adults to take responsibility for their actions, for their perspective, because that's the only way you're going to actually try to be a good parent and break that cycle.
You know, Abel, I think that's incredible. And I think what that demonstrates one of our hero traits, which is empathy. So it's like trying to be able to put yourself in another's shoes. And I know my on my dad's side, he came with kind of a history of abuse and other things. And he made that intentional decision to say, this is going to stop with me. He, you know, he reflected on it back and it changed the whole trajectory of my family lineage too. Like when you do that, and you know, that's too what you're trying to do. Right. And so I think it takes a lot of courage for you to share what you've been through. I know you said that like for a long time you didn't talk about this. So I'm wondering, was there like catalyst that kind of pushed you to say, you know what, it's, I want to start telling people about where I came from?
There was, I'm very fortunate. I'm the oldest boy of four, right? Compared with my dad and his, and his sons. But my younger brother, Matthew, was really ahead of me in the game as far as perspective and what it meant to grow up and to be responsible. Me and him would have conversations. We're a lot closer because of the transition, right? Between the two, us two went through almost the same thing. And my other two brothers also went through. My other two brothers did not get away unharmed. They went through a lot when they were up there still with my mom. She was just, again, she couldn't do the best job. And again, I don't blame her for that. I'm not saying that that's the main thing. I'm just saying that she wasn't taught that either, right? So this goes down the line. So I love my mom. I talk to her whenever I can, and my father too. You know, I still have a relationship with them, you know, and I'm always trying to grow that relationship a little bit, you know. It's really hard, but I don't have any resentment and I don't hate them, you know, and that's really crazy. You people think, oh man, well, they did this, they did that. No, yeah, but I don't know what happened to them, man. I mean, I feel bad because of what happened to them. I'm choosing to come out of that. They can choose to come out of that, understand that, but they're adults. That's up to them. But for me and my family going forward, we were going to come out of that. We're going to break that cycle. Between me and my four brothers, we ended up all living together here in Texas, and we were going to raise ourselves and stuff. We had a quote, and we kept it, and we stuck to it. And they said, the quote was, break the cycle. A lot of my uncles in my family, they were alcoholics, you know, they were alcoholics, and some of them were abusive and stuff like that. And I said, we're not going to be that. Us four are not going to be that. And we made that conscious decision as four brothers to say that we were going to break that cycle. But a catalyst for speaking is that when I noticed that with my brother, when I was real with him and he was real with me, it was uncomfortable. It wasn't fun. We had to admit certain things that we were wrong. And when we left that the next day or a couple of days later, there was a new piece. There was another level of, we're going to be okay. But if we didn't do that, it was just continuing on with resentment and blame and all these other things. So it was really important to have those tough conversations. And there's a few quotes that I like, you know, tough decisions, easy life, easy decisions, tough life. It's very simple. But if you're just going with the easy route, you're not going to really like what the results are. It's going to be tough. But if you make tough decisions, you're going to actually find peace a lot sooner.
So why Texas? How did you go from Chicago to Texas?
Yeah, so that's the continuing on, you know, from what happened with my parents. My family in Texas, they heard about what had happened in Chicago. So my family's originally from Texas, both of my parents, but they went to Chicago to pursue life and business and things like that and to be up there. My grandpa from my mom's side was up there. So he was selling tires, so they all decided to do that. So for that reason, my family was in Chicago, but they're originally from here, from South Texas. But half of them were here in Texas and half are in Chicago. When my family here in Texas found out, which is my dad's side, they said, that's not good. We want them. Send them over here. If no one's going to take care of them, send them over here. And they literally, I'm not sure if they made a deal or barter or paid, but they had one of my uncles pack us up, pick us up, and drive us over here to Texas. You know, I was 10, Matthew was 9, and we came to Texas and we were by ourselves. No dad, no mom, no brothers, no sister. And we had to start life here. But we got here, and I tell people it was the greatest thing that ever happened, you know, it's just bringing us to Texas. Our family was very loving. They were very supportive. We're different. Matthew and I were different because we were raised in Chicago and they were raised here, but we just came in and they accepted us full on. They took over. My aunt like became my mom. My grandma became my mom. My uncle became my dad. Like they all came in to help us raise us, you know? So that helped me and Matthew. And we were here for quite a few years by ourselves without our family.
Okay. So you're down in Texas, and then was it 20 or 23 when you discovered you had rheumatoid arthritis on top of everything? What was that? How old were you?
So I started getting symptoms. That's why the story is like 20 or 23. Well, the symptoms started when I was 20. It was very, very distinctive. And I was wondering why I felt like this way or whatever, but I just thought it was general arthritis. I thought I was a very active kid no matter what. I was always very active. I was always outside playing, just using it as a distraction, playing sports. And I remember people telling me, like, hey, man, you need to slow down. You need to take care of yourself or you're gonna be really messed up, you know, by the time you're 40. I life went on for me. I tried to play football. I tried to graduate high school. I did all these things, you know. I'm still very active in training and exercise. And I realized, you know, when I was 20, I'm like, well, man, I did do a lot of stuff. I was very rough. I went all out on everything. You know, instead of 20, I'm getting it at 40. I'm getting arthritis. All right, I'm just going to have to deal with it. Because at that moment, literally in my 20th year, I had just got legal custody of my two younger brothers. So, you know, this is a very popular story of mine, but the two older brothers, me and Matthew, we went to Chicago, or I went to Chicago, and I just made a deal with Matthew, and I told him, hey, I need your support. But we brought my younger brothers, Eddie and Jacob, from Chicago and move them to Texas. We knew that that was going to be probably one of the best things that we could do for them as far as their personal growth and their happiness, because they were very depressed in Chicago with my mom and her new family and stuff. My mom remarried and we have more brothers now, but she wasn't able to take care of them, you know, and I talked to her about it, and we had a tough conversation when I was 17 that I want to adopt them. I want to take them to Texas. I want them to be raised from now in Texas. They were probably like 10 and 11 at that point. And she said, no, you know, she was right. She said, hey, you're not mature enough to take care of them. And I took that as a personal challenge. You know, I said, okay, fine. I'm going to prove to you that I'm mature enough and I'm going to take care of them, you know, and I'm going to ask you again. So it took me 3 years. I graduated high school, got a good job. I bought a car. I did all those things. And when I was 20, I asked her again if I could take my brothers to Texas to raise them there. And she said yes. So that's when we literally packed them up in a couple of weeks and we moved to Texas, all four of us. You know, and that was the first time we were all living together, you know, in a long time. That's a huge thing. I mean, a lot of people talk about that as a 20-year-old. My brother was 19. We both took this on together to raise them. We were going to be their parents, right? Because my parents couldn't do it. My father was still in limbo, alcoholic, drugs, in trouble, in and out of jail, you know, and he was around, but he was in and out of jail. Just, we couldn't rely on him or even trust him with stuff, you know? So it was me and Matthew trying to take care of my two young brothers, Eddie and Jacob. And we took on the responsibility when I was 20. And that's when I started getting symptoms. And I was like, well, looking back at it, maybe that was a traumatic event that triggered rheumatoid arthritis in me, you know, or maybe it was just all the things I did. But it was very interesting at that timing of when I started really getting symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis. But I had just got custody of my brothers, so I had to work. So with this pain that I was feeling in my knees and in my hands, all I did was like, look, I don't got time for this. I have to work. I have to support them. I just got them and I started taking painkillers and I covered it up. And then by the time 3 years into that, if you cover up rheumatoid arthritis for 3 years, you're going to start to see it attacking you, not just feel it. And then I've talked about this story quite a bit too. You know, I was back at home, you know, and I was putting some shorts on and I was going to go outside to do something, whether it was play or work outside or cut grass. But I put on my shorts and I went to tie my shoe and I got a glimpse of my knee, you know, without pants on and stuff. And I looked at my knee and I literally was like confused. I'm like, what is going on with my knee here? This is kind of weird. I was in shock. Also, I'm like, man, what's going on here? That's not my knee. I literally said, that's not my knee, to my right knee. And I panicked. So I looked at my left one right away and I'm like, what's going on? And I was like, I thought I was in a dream. And I'm like, what is going on? My knee looks really messed up. That's not the knee that I grew up with. That's not the knee that I used to play football with or lift weights with. And I was just so in shock, and that was it. Once I saw that physical damage, I made an appointment the next day, and I went to the doctor the next day, and that was it. Yeah, I held off for 3 years, you know, and then when you see something like that, it snaps you back into reality. I had to go to the doctor.
So, but you're clearly, like, physically able.
Yeah, so I feel right? Like, that's why we're all able. That's why.
Like, physically able. Anyway, so I just, like, you're an overcomer. And so I feel like all the things could have taken anybody else down, but I feel like you actually have reformatted and to use that to face your fears or your challenges. Like, how did you recover emotionally, or how have you brought healing to yourself spiritually, emotionally, and then physically?
Yeah. Let me talk on how I got out of that. So just because that's really important, I think people always ask me, like, man, how do you do this? How do you have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an incurable autoimmune disease, right? I'm going to have it forever. I tell people I'm sick right now. Mm. You can't tell, right? But I'm sick. I tell them that. And I tell them that to get their attention, because they need to realize, look, I'm out there doing whatever I want. You know, I look at how strong I am. Look at how athletic I am. I'm not worried about this and that. But how when I'm sick, right? And I tell them it's because, first of all, I don't think I'm sick. I was never going to accept that that's it. So the doctor told me, and this is the way they told me, literally. They're like, hey, you have rheumatoid arthritis. There's not much we can do. This was a long time ago. You know, there wasn't medications for it yet. There was only like, I think they were like trying stuff out to see if it was going to help with rheumatoid arthritis. But there was nothing they could do for me. Literally said, look, there's nothing we can do for you. You have about 7 years of movement left. After that, you're going to need to replace your right knee and your right hip. They're both spinning out really bad. And I knew that too. I could tell that my right foot was spinning out. I tried to keep it in, but it was just going on. I couldn't stop it. And he's like, you're going to be in a wheelchair. You know, you're going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. You only have about 7 years. I was 23, so that put me at 30 for complete disability. And this was, I believed him because I could see what he was talking about. It was right there in front of me. I didn't know what rheumatoid arthritis was. And he's like, look, all we can do is we can give you a prescription for a much stronger pain pill because it's going to hurt. And like, it already hurts. I take 6 to 8 painkillers a day, 4 in the morning, 4 at night. If I don't do that, I can't move in 2 or 3 days. So I was like, dude, I'm already doing that. If you can't help me, that's fine. I literally said, that's fine. Then I'm not coming back. I'm going to do this myself. He wrote me a prescription. So this is symbolism, right? He wrote me a prescription for a bigger pain pill. And I sat in my car and I was thinking about it. I crumpled the prescription. I said, I'm not even going to get this. And I just threw it away. I don't even know. I just threw it away. If he can't help me, that's fine. But I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to stop this. I'm going to find one person that has gotten relief from this illness somehow. And I'm going to do everything I can. So I was 23 and I just started studying health and nutrition. I started studying rheumatoid arthritis. I found out what it was. And the very first thing I did was change the definition. And this is, we talked about perspective right before we started recording, but that's the biggest thing. The biggest thing is your perspective on how you see stuff. I looked it up, rheumatoid arthritis, an incurable autoimmune disease. And I said, that's not what it is. My body's confused. Why would my body attack itself? I started asking questions that outside of that. Why would my body attack itself? My body wants to live more than I do. Why would it attack itself? I said, well, it's confused. What's confusing it? Maybe there's something I'm eating. Maybe there's something I'm putting on my skin. Maybe there's something that's someone I'm hanging out with that's causing some chemical confusion in my body. And that's causing this reaction. What if it's an allergic reaction? What? Maybe this is just a chronic allergic reaction. So with that, I took rheumatoid arthritis and I said, I changed the definition. I'm having an allergic reaction. Let me find out what's causing this. So I cleaned everything. I stopped everything that I was doing, everything from the water I was drinking to the foods. And I just started studying it and taking everything out that had somewhat of controversy. So any food that could be somewhat controversial, whether or not it's healthy or not, I took it out of my diet. And I just did that and I started and again, it was just a mental change first because that was going to lead to me actually taking action. And I studied health and nutrition late into the night. I read everything I could read, everything I could see. I would study till 3, 4 in the morning. I speak to college students a lot. And I said, look, I was studying more than you were. I was studying to save my life. I had a deeper reason. You guys are studying to get an education, to get a career, but I was studying to save my life. So I was up 3, 4 in the morning trying to figure out what was going on. And I was reading everything I could. And then I made changes. I took action. I applied those changes. I tried everything. Whether I believed it was going to work or not, it didn't matter. There were some people that were getting results doing things that I didn't think would work. They didn't make any sense, but I was going to try it. So back then, MySpace was really big as a social media platform. It was like the first big one. And I was just asking questions and looking for people and searching for rheumatoid arthritis. And I found like a person. I found one person that said, hey, I used to have rheumatoid arthritis, but I control it with this. I reduced symptoms with this. This took my pain away. And I would just reach out to everybody. I don't even know if anybody ever replied, but that was enough for me to say, hey, you can find a way. And that's what I did.
Okay. So you're trying to find a way, right? And then you're getting more into health and nutrition. And so let's jump to like how American Ninja Warrior got into this whole mix.
So it took me about, I think, 3 or 4 months to stop the pain of rheumatoid arthritis, which was not the physical damage because that took a lot longer. I still have a little bit of, you can see signs in my body of the damage that was done, which is really cool because I didn't take any tests. I didn't take any blood work tests or anything like that. Back in the day, you know, I was just like, hey, let's, you know, look, there's something seriously wrong with me. Look, I can't believe what's going on in my body here. So it took me about 3 or 4 months and I was changing everything. I was trying all these things. And I said, well, I don't know if it's going to work because I'm still taking painkillers every day. I was taking 4 in the morning, 4 at night at least. Because I knew that if I didn't take those painkillers in 3 days, I couldn't open my hand anymore. And I remember thinking that when you have rheumatoid arthritis and you can check into other people and stuff, for me, it was a chronic, constant pain. So I was never not in pain. For some people, they go into pain and they get out. For me, it was constant all the time. So if I didn't take those painkillers in 3 days, I couldn't open my hands. In like 4 or 5 days, I couldn't walk anymore. The pain was so severe that my legs would not work. And I would send a command, like a man, it's almost like a paralysis. I would say, I need to open my hand so I can grab the doorknob. And my hand wouldn't open because it knew how much it was going to hurt. It was really interesting to go through that, you know, so that's why I took those painkillers. But I said, I'm not going to know if all these things are working if I'm on painkiller. So I decided, okay, today's the day, no more painkillers. And I'll find out in 3 days if this is working. So I stopped. I stopped taking the painkillers. And day one, I know it's generally okay because it's still in my system. Right, still in your blood. Day two is starting to come out. You know, you're starting to clean up a little bit. And by the third day, if I can open my hand with no pain, then I'm good. And that happened. I opened my hand and I said, my pain is gone. From right there, like you talk about being set free. I literally set myself free. I felt like there was nothing I couldn't do. I was just told by doctors and everybody in the entire medical field that there's nothing that can be done, but I did it myself. Now there's nothing I can't do now. So I just took that and kept on running with it. I was like, dude, if I could do this, I'm going to keep on reading. I'm going to keep on training. I'm going to keep on doing this. I'm going to take this as far as I can. And I did that. I was 23, going on 24. By the time I was in 25, I was in the best shape of my life, and I couldn't believe the things that I was doing. People would see me work out, and they would just turn their heads and be like, well, what is going on? And then I was training and training. So how far can I take this? How strong can I get? How athletic can I get? And I started playing all of these sports. I was just on fire. And then one day I was 28 years old, and I'm looking at TV, and I see this guy on TV, an American Ninja Warrior, and he's doing the cliffhanger on his fingertips, and he's beating this cliffhanger. And I'm like, that's impossible. How is that guy doing that? And I'm strong. And I thought I was strong. And I saw him, and he's a good friend of mine now. He's just my first inspiration to be a Ninja Warrior, Brian Arnold. And, you know, we're really good friends now. And I saw him, I was like, man, that's insane. That's impossible. But he's doing it. And I can do it too. And I went after it. I said, I'm gonna apply in one year. I'm gonna learn everything I can about this. I'm gonna dive deep into it. I'm gonna watch every video, read every article, and study all these people. And one day I'm gonna go out there and try out. And I'm gonna try out next year. That story is also crazy too, the whole trial process, because I didn't get picked. I wasn't selected for the show. They didn't call me or anything like that, even though I applied and sent in, you know, a really good video and all this other stuff. I thought I was going to get the call, and I didn't get the call. But I was 28, and I walked on when I was 29.
So you're reminding me a little bit about like the Energizer Bunny. Or I guess a better way to say it would be like carpe diem. You seize the day, where you're like, I feel great. I'm going to go out and live life. And I mean, that's incredible, because how many of us sometimes, like, we're just kind of like, oh, I'm tired, or, you know, we have our own excuses, but you know, how important it is to, I mean, you have overcome a lot. Like, I think Anne was right. Like, you are an overcomer. So Ninja Warriors, and you're awesome. And how many seasons have you been on?
This is my seventh season. Yeah.
Seven years.
Yeah. It's really hard just to do one attempt, you know, and I've been on it now for 7 years. So,
Okay. So now talk to us about, so you're in this like super south town of Texas, right? Like almost on the border of Mexico. And the gyms, you were telling us before we started, that the closest gym is like 3.5 hours away, right? Like a ninja training gym.
Yeah.
So you decide to open up your own gym. Talk to us about that dream that you had, and then kind of how it got started.
Yeah. So when I decided to try out for the show, you know, I was going to have to train on obstacles. I needed to know what that was like. And I'm like, when it comes to learning, I know how to learn things. I'm a very good learner. I feel like I can learn anything, even from a 6-year-old student. So I take in everything. I'm very observant. And I knew that I had to be around those obstacles, you know, but the closest gym was 6 hours away. It was in Houston. So I went up there 2 times before I actually walked onto the stage in American Ninja Warrior. So yeah, that's why I was talking about my movement training. Movement training is just this training that's going to allow you to do anything you're physically capable of. So that confidence, right? That there's no doubt that I'm going to go out there and I'm going to mimic this movement. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that, because I know my movement so well that I know how to just translate what you just did into my body and make it happen. So I know I needed that. I've been a big fan of that for a long time. And that's kind of the training that prepped me for a Ninja Warrior before I knew I was going to be a Ninja Warrior. But I had always wanted to open a gym. That was a goal of mine before, because I was into training and football. So I wanted a place to lift weights. That was mine. And I had made that commitment to open a gym a long time ago. I just didn't know at this point it was going to be a gym like this, you know, an American Ninja Warrior gym. But that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to train, and there was a lot of interest in it. You know, people wanted to be Ninja Warriors. They wanted to train. Once I got on the show, you know, I blew up. I was pretty much rookie of the year. I had a historic season. It was really insane how much I blew up instantly. And then people just started coming. And I'm like, man, well, I train over here at my friend's house. Let's train. We'll do this. All of a sudden, we had this outdoor gym that just blew up and became world famous. And that transition from the outdoor, a backyard course, to a business and indoor was something I wanted to do. I needed to make that happen to keep this thing going. And since then, I mean, pre-COVID, we had full roster, and we had a 4-month waiting list to get in to get a chance to try out our.
Yeah, amazing. Congrats. And also, like, I'm obviously looking at your shirt too, and it says hashtag we are all able, which is amazing. So can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, it's funny because I love my name. I mean, I think everybody really loves their name, but for me, my name's it's a word, right? You know, it's not just a name. And it's a funny story because I was talking to a girl I was like interested in and stuff, and she was being smart with me because my name's Abel. And she said, "So are you able?" You know, we were in a conversation. She tried to be smart with me. It's like, "Are you able?" It's like, "I'm very able. We are all able." And when I said that, she was like, "Hey, that was good. That was a nice line." I was like, "Oh, I'm gonna save that. Yeah, I'm gonna save that line." But from there, it really hit me. I was like, "Dude, what does it mean to say something like that?" And it's really easy. You know, we were talking about it. I haven't even gone through half of the things that I've gone through in my life to get to where I am with you guys during this talk.
Oh yeah.
But that list is long. It's very long. But if I went and every one of those things could have stopped me from being where I am today. But why didn't it stop me? If I was able to go through all those things and get here and do actually what I wanted with my life, I mean, this is what I wanted to do, then why can't you? You could. I had it way worse than most people. I have students in here, they're 20 years old, they're 18, they're in the best shape of their life, right? Quote unquote. But they can't touch me on this stuff. And I'm the one that's 20 years older and I'm the one that's sick. So you should be way better than me. And why not?
Hashtag truth.
We are all.
Those of us who are like, you know, just worried about the COVID-19 as far as like gaining 19 pounds. You're like, no.
I worked harder than ever during this shutdown. I worked harder than ever and I'm a high risk individual. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
I have a chronic illness. I have an autoimmune disease that's forever, and I worked harder than ever. My gym might have been shut down, but I didn't shut down. I was working, and I finished my gym during that time. I used that time, and it was really tough. COVID has hurt my business, and it's hurt a lot of my students and a lot of families down here, and it's been really tough. But it's a pandemic. I mean, that word is scary off the bat. Around the world, we know that pandemics are the hardest times that have ever happened to humans. You know, so we should expect that. And there's a few things before you say anything, but there's a few things about hard times and problems. I expect problems. They're going to come. Come. When I beat you, I'm going to be better.
Well, I think that acknowledges like reality. I think that's also what you're talking about when you're being really honest and having those really difficult conversations with your brother. Mm-hmm. And that it would just actually, it helps you to not live in denial. I'm going to switch topics a little bit, but similar, I think. Along your lines of, I think the hero trait that comes to mind when I listen to your story is the hero trait of grit. But I think it's not like grit as in like just in and of itself, but I think grit for a purpose.
You need purpose.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. You won't have it. You won't have grit without purpose. You know, grit without purpose is more just self. It's more of an insecurity in my mind. You're just doing it just to do it, to say you did this. No, for me, grit was, this is all me. And I also talk about selfishness. It was very selfish to put me first. It was very selfish for me to stop everything I was doing and say, you need to get healthy. You need to solve this problem because you have your brothers there. They're relying on you. They were still very young and I was supporting them, you know, me and Matthew. So I said, look, you need to stop. You need to put yourself first because if you die or if you become disabled, your brothers are going to have to take care of you. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. You're supposed to lead by example. You're supposed to take care of yourself. If you're not healthy, you can't help your brothers. So it was very selfish for me to put me first, but my health was number one. I started studying all that stuff, all that time. I was not around people. I was not around my friends and family. I was not doing this. I wasn't hanging out. I wasn't partying. I was very selfish. I was taking this because there's always two versions of almost the same action. And to be selfish, right? For me to take care of myself and put myself first allowed me to take care of everybody else. It allowed me to inspire millions of people around the country. If I didn't put myself first, I would be in a wheelchair right now and you all would not know who I am.
And you wouldn't be making the impact that you are on your family and also in your community with all the kids in your gym.
Mm-hmm. It's really important to take care of yourself first because in that you can either inspire without even trying. I didn't go to American Ninja Warrior to inspire millions around the world. I went over there because I knew I had an ability to do this and I knew I wanted to do it for me so that I can take my athleticism. My entire life, I didn't tell you this in the beginning, but my entire life, I was raised to become a professional football player. I mean, I could throw perfect spirals by the time I was 5-6 years old, but all those things, all those setbacks, all that stuff did not allow that to happen. And then I gave it up because I had to take care of my brothers. I wanted to take care of my brothers. I gave it up. I didn't even play football my senior year. I said, I'm going to take care of my brothers. I'm going to make it through high school. I'm going to graduate. I was the first person to graduate my family so that they could graduate. I knew if I didn't graduate, they weren't going to graduate. From then, all three of my brothers graduated. You know, when no one else in my family did. So there's a selfishness in that, but that selfishness has a deeper impact because it shows you the big picture. If I didn't do that, everything would be completely different right now.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the hero traits is actually intentionality. And so you have to know yourself and focus on yourself in order to be the best version of yourself, right? And to give the world what only you can give them. So I just wonder, so we have to wrap up time here, but Abel, can you just give a word of encouragement for people who are going through really challenging times right now? I mean, would you say you're on the other side of it, or do you still kind of regularly kind of feel big emotions?
Yeah, no, I definitely think the perspective, right? The perspective of life, what is life? And I listen to a lot of Stoics. So mm-hmm. I like that perspective and that deeper vision of what is life and your actions as an individual and who mm-hmm. you are, you know, Marcus Aurelius and things like that. And they talk about, it's actually selfish to take things personally, because that means that you're putting yourself in front of everything, right? So that's why it's hard to differentiate what is selfish. Selfish has both a good version and a bad version. The same way pride does, you know, pride. Oh, I'm very proud of my brother for graduating high school. Oh, I'm so proud that I'm not going to take advice from someone that's younger than me. See, those two different versions of, you need to be able to separate those things and know when you're being one over the other. And when you do that, if you can look at it deeper, you don't have to take those things personally. When you don't take them personally, I don't see a problem come into life and say, oh, why me? Why me? Right? That's me taking it personally, because it's way bigger than that. The truth is, life is nothing but problem and solve, problem and solve, problem and solve, good times, bad times, good times, bad times. Everybody's life has always been that. It doesn't matter who you are. You can be born rich or in a rich family, but you're still going to have problems. You'll see it. And usually those are more people problems or communication problems. It doesn't matter. But you're going to have all these problems. When a problem comes into me, I might take it personal and be upset for like 10 seconds. And that's it. All right, I got to figure out how I'm going to get behind this. Or what do you do? Get creative. Start thinking. You know, what did you learn from all the mentors you've had? I've had many, many, many great mentors in my life. And that's mentors that have shaped me into who I am. I'm not going to take credit for that at all. I was angry. I was a troublemaker. I was a bully growing up. I did not make myself into who I am today. I had people guiding me, people that I trusted, people with integrity. They helped me become who I am. And I had, the list is long, and I'm really appreciative to those men. And they say terms the way you just said it, you know, to be a better version of yourself. One of my mentors, that was his one of his main sayings. But yeah, if you don't take problems personal, just know that they're coming and your job is to overcome them. When you overcome them, you're going to be happier with yourself and you're going to grow. And that's a constant life cycle.
Wow, you're kind of like, I'm exhausted listening to you.
Oh, no.
you just like are taking on life, you know, full force. I love it. I love it.
Coffee. I have organic coffee every day. And I train. I also still train. I train 3-4 times a week still.
Incredible.
So, well, actually, to be honest, I think that Lori, you should become a ninja.
You know, it's kind of funny. So, Abel, I have to tell you this. When I was dropping off our son for the first time, two of the coaches at the gym actually said, oh, you should, because I was like, oh, I could never do that. They're like, oh, no, you should try that because you're tiny. So you can move fast. I'm only 5'1". I was like, huh, like I've never thought about it. But now I may be inspired talking to you.
This sport is very unique because we're going to compete against each other, but not really, because we're competing against the course. So, and I know that if I see you succeed, then there's a higher chance for me to succeed. We know that, like, just in statistics, you can look at studies. When somebody sees something, your chances, in other words, if I just saw 10 people run this obstacle and all 10 fell, what am I going to think? Oh man, this obstacle is impossible. I'm not going to beat it. But if I see 10 people fall and then the 9 people fall and the last person gets it, oh my God, so we can do this. Right? It's huge. So we support each other. We're all friends. We don't, there's a uniqueness about the sport too. You don't grow up in an environment saying, hey, you're gonna become an American Ninja Warrior and you're gonna get paid millions of dollars, you know, by the time you're 19, 20 years old. We don't have that at all. So this sport has kept that humbleness in there, you know, that, hey, this is bigger than that. This is bigger than money. Most of us have to pay to do this. You know, we don't get paid to do this at all. For me, it's the ultimate test in my athleticism. And I have both boys and girls in my classes. This sport is for everybody, but it's going to look different for everybody, but you can still go out there and get that same sensation, that same instant gratification, that same feeling of, hey, I'm proud I'm going after this.
Well, keep up the great work, Abel. It's been great talking to you. And where can we find you on social media?
Honestly, it's very easy to get a hold of me on Instagram. That's probably my favorite one to have conversation and stuff. Just change this to @, but it's We Are All Able. A-B-E-L.
Improper version of this spelling.
Yeah, so that's the name spelling, I guess, of it. So A-B-E-L, we are all able. They can reach me on Instagram. There, it's very easy to find me. And they can also get me on Facebook. I'm also still very active on Facebook. And I'm easy to reach out to. You know, usually, generally when you message me, you're going to talk to me, you know, for the most part.
Yeah, which is how I got in touch with you.
Yes.
Well, thanks, Abel. And thanks, Anne, for another great conversation. Yes, and thank you guys for listening. If you like this episode, then share it with other people, pass the word on, and then go and watch American Ninja Warrior. Talk to you guys next time.